few informational items, but I just wanted to let you know that it's important for Michael that we pull names out random. We don't know what questions or comments may be coming at him. If you could, you know, it's just common courtesy, but I'll just say it again, if we could keep it civil at all times. Hopefully, I know we're pretty passionate about why we're here. And I'm reminiscing about my days in Carbondale. And if you can keep it concise, because we'd like to hear from as many people. This is your time, our time to interact with our great senator. And this is actually his 13th town hall in the last few months.
Can you hear me, or can you? Should I use the microphone? Okay. I want to thank all of you for being here. I really appreciate it. I know that you've got busy lives and you've got things to do, so I'm very, very grateful that you're here. We started about 3 minutes late, so we'll end about 3 minutes late because I want to make sure we get the full hour in. I'm not going to give you a speech. My invitation, and again, we're going to pick names out of a hat because I don't want anybody to think anybody's screening the questions. That I'm happy to take questions on any topic, and I'm happy to take criticism on any topic as well. And you shouldn't feel in any way constrained. You will not hurt my feelings. And if you're here to try to hurt my feelings, you won't hurt my feelings. I was an urban school superintendent for almost 6 years. For the teachers in this room, you know, it was all beaten out of me a long time ago. I'm not going to say anything else except to observe that it's a very interesting time in Washington, D.C. There is a lot at stake, both internationally and domestically. There's a lot at stake in terms of what kind of country we're going to turn over to our kids and our grandkids and what America's role in the world is going to be. And that's the reason I've been doing these town halls, is so that I can go back and credibly say, I've listened to the people of Colorado, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Here where consensus emerges. Is that all right? Can you hear me now? Here's where consensus emerges on some issues, and here's where there's disagreement about other issues. I started out these town halls not in a Democratic place, but in El Paso County, Colorado Springs, and then I went from there to Pueblo and Alamosa and Durango, and stopped at the hospital in Delta, and then went to Grand Junction and had a town hall there, and then Fort Collins, Boulder, Denver, was in Hugo, Colorado, where last week, where I asserted that I'm the first statewide elected official to ever be in Hugo, Colorado 4 times. And there were a bunch of old timers there at the VFW hall, and not a single one contradicted me. That turned into a town hall, and then I was in La Junta, and today I'm in Frisco and Edwards in here, and when we're done tonight, I'm going to drive back and see my kids. And that leads me to Stacy to say thank you, because Stacy took me and my family horseback riding, now I think about 4 years ago, so that we could really understand how unique and special a place the Thompson Divide is, and the protection that we need to have. Her leadership is very important to that. So with that, that is it. That's it for speeches. Now I'm all yours.
Great. Thanks, Michael. So I have Bob Semro, David Schroeder, and Robert Hunker. Please make your way down. And
where are we going to?
If you can just make it over here, that'd be great.
Well, Senator, thank you for being here.
Thank you for letting me come.
I think we'd be happy to have you. My question is about healthcare, and I'm a little concerned about the ACA repeal passing in the Senate. I know that Senator Portman and Moore Capito have now decided to sign up to the bill. I also heard that they're talking about making those Medicaid expansion spending caps. They're talking about changing those now every couple of years to bring the moderates into the picture. I'm concerned that it's going to pass. I'd like you to tell me if I'm right or wrong about that. And also, could you tell me what you think the impact would be to Colorado, since Colorado is a Tabor state and would have a very hard time filling that shortfall?
Yeah, so thank you very much for the question. Couple thoughts. One, I've not only done all these town halls, I've been traveled all over the state, all over the state, and all over the state. And a lot of the conversations I've had over the years about healthcare have been about healthcare. And some people have been against Obamacare, some people have been for Obamacare. I voted for it, obviously. There is a lot of unhappiness with the way the American healthcare system works. And it, particularly where we are right now and in the communities that I've been in today, these are among the places in America where it's most expensive to buy health insurance, where it's most difficult to get a doctor, and where people have no predictability at all about healthcare. I was in Frisco earlier today. I went to visit the clinic that's there, and I asked them, "What's your revenue at this clinic? Where does it come from?" Said 53% of the people that come here are people that have no health insurance. 33% of the people that come here are people that are on Medicaid, and the rest of the people are people that have insurance. And I said, well, that's really strange. How can 53% of the people be here uncompensated? How could they not be on Medicaid? And the answer was, because of the kind of community in which they live, they make too much money to be on Medicaid, but not enough money to be on private insurance. That is a huge problem in our state, and I say that as somebody who voted for the Affordable Care Act. It's a huge problem with the Affordable Care Act. Having said that, if I were to set out to write a bill less responsive to the critics of Obamacare in Colorado, less responsive to the critics of our healthcare system, many of them Republicans, and I assume there are many Republicans here today, so I'm happy to be disputed on this point. But if I set out to write a bill less responsive to their criticism of what's happening in our healthcare system, I couldn't write a bill less responsive than the House healthcare bill. And why is that? Because in all these meetings, not a single person has come up to me and said, what we need to do to get more predictable, cheaper healthcare for people in Colorado is to cut taxes for the richest Americans by $440 billion. I haven't heard a single person say that. I haven't heard a single person say, let's cut the insurance company's taxes by $200 billion. But that's what this bill does. Why? So they can cut Medicaid by $880 billion, which is a quarter of the Medicaid program. Yesterday I was in Washington on the Finance Committee, always on my best behavior, and the Secretary of HHS was testifying, and I said, I'm going to describe for you what I believe to be the Medicaid population in Colorado, and please tell me if you think I'm wrong, if I'm not telling the truth, that half the people on Medicaid in Colorado are children, that a huge number of people that consume Medicaid are people who have spent down their life savings for the privilege of being in a nursing home that's paid for by Medicaid. And then there are a whole bunch of people that work, but because we have a different set of priorities than a lot of other places, they work, but they can't afford private insurance, and they're on Medicaid. And he said, that's true. That's who's on Medicaid in Colorado. And I said, well, when you listen to Paul Ryan and these guys in the House, what you hear is there are a whole bunch of people in America that aren't working and are just taking Medicaid. And that's the justification for cutting Medicaid by 25%. That would be, to answer your question, a disaster for our state, a disaster for rural Colorado in particular, and I think a disaster for the United States of America. We cannot do it. And it is not fiscally responsible. They say it's fiscally responsible. Maybe if Garfield County or if Glenwood is willing to throw people out of nursing homes and not pay for their care, maybe if you don't think that the 50% of the people that are kids, you know, maybe you should think they should go get a job instead of being in school. So this is nuts, and it's driven by politics. It's not driven by the way the system doesn't work in Colorado. So in the Senate, I am really worried now that they're going to pass a bill. I didn't think, until this week, I did not think they would be able to pass a bill, and I thought and I hoped that Mitch McConnell's strategy was to try to pass a bill in the Senate with Republicans, that he would fail with Republicans, and then he would say, we now need a bipartisan solution. Because we do need a bipartisan solution. This isn't going to be done by one party or the other party. And I worry that if they pass it, we're never going to get that chance. And we're going to see the kind of cuts to rural hospitals and that because of Tabor and other things, we're going to have a very, very hard time backfilling. And then matters will be worse. And then a year from now, you're going to say to me, why is it even harder? We never thought it could get harder to get insurance where we live than it was in 2017, but you've actually made it harder. Why have you made it harder? So here's what I would say to the assembly on this, and I'll stop. This is likely to come up between now and July 4th. And it's not a foregone conclusion that it's going to pass. It's not a foregone conclusion that people are going to vote for it. And we've got a senator in this state who wrote a letter to the majority leader, Cory Gardner, who was one of four senators who said that he didn't approve of the House Medicaid cuts. And I think people back there need to hear that you care about this and that you're paying attention and that you're watching. I will do whatever it is I can do. I hope you will do whatever it is you can do over the next 2 weeks to make your voices heard. It's going to be a very important moment in the history of healthcare in the United States of America. And then, one way or another, we have to get back to working together to try to create a system that allows people in America to have the same sort of freedom. That's the word they use in the House. I'm for freedom. I want people not to be so fearful of their healthcare system and to not have to make choices that no one else in the industrialized world has to make about their families or being able to go to college versus paying for your health insurance. It's ridiculous that 53% of these people at Frisco can't afford, either can't get Medicaid or can't afford to buy private insurance. It's just not acceptable to me.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. With Donald Trump having shown by his support from Russian oligarchs starting in the mid-1980s for his floundering empire, and then throughout his campaign, his romance with Putin, and then his foreign policy moves to include when his team removed the portion of the Republican platform that called for maintaining sanctions on Russia for their Crimean actions, and then now that he's distanced America from NATO and from the Eurozone, it's looking more and more like there are some real problems there. How do we deal with him going forward?
So I think there are a couple things. Can everybody hear the question?
No.
Do you want to repeat it? Because you'll do it justice, and I will
put the microphone up here.
Okay, here you go.
Perfect.
The romance, funny romance that Trump has with Putin, the fact that he probably had illegal funding to support his floundering empire, starting in the 1980s, the fact that they have made several foreign policy moves, even before he was elected, that show that he's in the tank for the Kremlin, as far as I'm concerned. I just wonder how we move forward with that.
Okay. So there are a couple things. First of all, I think it's important for us. I am a broken record at this point on trying to protect America's institutions.
Can you hear me now? I'm sorry. Just yell out if you can't hear it. I appreciate that. I'm now a broken record on the floor of the Senate and other places on the protection of America's institutions. I think there are some things that are very, very fundamental that are at risk that we need to be fighting for, including the independence of the judiciary, including checks and balances in our federal government, including freedom of the press. And I never thought those things would be in danger, but they are in danger right now, and we need to fight for those things. It is in that spirit that I say to you, I think we have to let these investigations run their course. And we have to be advocates for the rule of law and say that we've got to see what the special counsel discovers in the special counsel's investigation and what the committees discover in their investigation. And then we'll make a judgment about what we think the president did or didn't do. I would say, he's not taking my advice, but you know, I used to be a lawyer. I would say, you might want to get off the Twitter because it's not helping his own case. I'd be shocked if we had a special counsel. Yeah, disagree, stay on the Twitter. And one of the things we don't know yet is whether there was collusion with the campaign and all that. That's what the investigations need to figure out. So let's park that for a second. What I am worried about is what he is saying about the Russians, what he is saying about the Europeans, what he is saying about the Saudis and the effect that's having on our national security and the national security and the security of the world. I can't explain it. I mean, you've got your explanation for it. I can't explain it, but here's what I do know. I do know that probably, well, first of all, you go back to the campaign and he said, well, what's wrong if we're friends, if Putin and I have a good friendship? That's good for America, isn't it? And then he gets elected and he said that NATO was obsolete. He said that before, he said it again. He didn't, when he went to Europe last week or the week before, he didn't say, we're all in this together, that I've got your backs. He said in public, you're not paying your fair share, which, by the way, is a recipe for getting other countries to say, we're not paying one more euro more into whatever it is you're asking us to do. And though Putin probably can't invade Western Europe without a lot of brain damage, having a president who's out there saying NATO is obsolete and the European Union is obsolete is a gift to you. And if you spend 10 minutes with any ambassador from Europe, I spent recently 10 minutes with the ambassador from Germany, what you hear is a hair-raising tale about what Russia is doing to interfere in democratic processes, in elections in Europe, which is no different from what they've done to the United States. There is not a person I'm aware of who has been briefed on the intelligence that does not think Russia materially interfered in our election, except for Donald Trump, who says maybe it was the Chinese. No one else believes that. No one else believes it. So we are being suckered here. And it is not in the national security interest of the United States to be calling into question the strength of the EU, to call into question the strength of NATO. And furthermore, I'll make one last point, because they're related. Look at the refugee crisis that's happening right now in Europe. Consider that crisis. A lot of that has been created by Russia. Syria is a complete mess. And Russia, working with Assad, has created a terrible refugee crisis there. And a lot of that has resulted in refugees streaming into Europe, immigrants streaming into Europe. And guess where they're not going? They're not going to the Balkans and to the satellite states around Russia. They're going into Western Europe, where the fact that they're there is destabilizing the politics of these countries in a direction that Putin loves, but in a direction we should be deeply concerned about. And so I'm not here to talk about motivation. I'm here to, my own view is that he just doesn't understand it. And we have to remain very vigilant about this now. And I didn't talk about the Middle East, but everything that I just said goes for the Middle East as well.
Could I have Valley Noon, Mary Sokol, and Teresa Hamilton congregate over here while we take this next question, please?
Thank you, Senator Bennett. My subject is really insignificant compared to what we have been, the first two questions. But nevertheless, it's about seniors, about Social Security. And I am speaking for 3 million people directly that are in the same situation I'm in. So right now on the Senate, a bill has been introduced, S-915, the Social Security Fairness Act of 2017. It was put on the floor by Senator Sherrod Brown just recently. What this bill will do is repeal the WEP and the government offset pension that influences those of us who are mostly low-income earners during our career. In fact, my Social Security payout is one half of what was basically, you know those yearly statements you get, you can expect to have a certain amount, it's one half. My question is, again, this is really insignificant compared to these serious issues, but there are those of us who have worked for years and years and paid into the system. I started in 1965, I retired at age 66.
What did you do, or where did you work?
I did many things. The thing with the windfall elimination provision, it's if you were paying in Social Security for part of your career, but then you go to work for a state organization. So many teachers in the past, right, and even today, are influenced by this bill. So would you please co-sponsor this bill?
I will. I have not looked at it, so okay. Let me look at it before I say that I will. We'll make a note, and I'll take a look at it next week.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking a look.
Sherrod Brown is a great guy, by the way.
I want to thank you for coming because Tipton and Gardner don't think we exist, even if they fundraise in town. So
I'm not having a fundraiser. I know you're all disappointed by that, but no, you're not.
But this relates also to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and health bill. We were flim-flammed by the House. No one really read the bill. They passed it. Is this going to happen in the Senate? We have now that it's going to be fast-tracked. We are not going to get to see it. You're not going to get to see it until who knows when, July 3rd. But now, we don't know if Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid is going to be taxed for the rich. If it is not, we'll have failure of all three of those systems, regardless of what they do with Medicaid in other respects. Also, having Medicaid be phased out in 7 years is despicable, just as it is in 3 years. Because as you said, a lot of people fit in those cracks. If my daughter works, she'll make too much for Medicaid. But if she works, she won't get insurance because she has pre-existing conditions and no one wants her. And her medical bills in a year are over $20,000 for medicine. How is she to survive? We can't defund Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I don't want it to end ever. It goes all the way up the ladder. I mean, we used to have a better system of doing this, and now it's all gone. We don't tax the rich 90% like we do. This has all gone the way with other bad Republicans. I mean, whether it's been Nixon, Reagan, Bush, they've all done stuff that has screwed the middle class and the poor, and only aggrandized the rich. So when are you going to know something about the bills and pass it out to us?
Well, so on that point, what do you know about the bill, I remember being criticized over and over again about the process in which the original health care bill was passed. And that it was too speedy, and it was too fast, and all the rest of it. Listen, we had, I don't remember the number of hearings now, but between the Finance Committee and the Health, Education, Labor Committee, we had gazillions of hearings, we had workshops, we had, the bill was available for everybody to read for months and months and months. It was all negotiated in public. And to my knowledge, the House of Representatives had one committee hearing on that bill before it was passed. It was written in Paul Ryan's office. And in the Senate, we have had no committee hearings. None, not one hearing that anybody here could look at and say, now I know what's in that Senate bill.
Well, Mr. Gardner doesn't seem to want to tell us anything that's going on.
And so I'll keep you posted as I learn it. I haven't seen it. They haven't given me anything to read.
But I don't want any of us to see
it. So I think it's very important for you to keep your eye on it. On Medicaid. The other thing is, I don't want folks to be suckered. Just because the House bill is so extremely horrible doesn't mean the Senate should get away with passing something that's like moderately less horrible. You know? Like, how about actually trying to address your daughter's situation instead of doing the will of a bunch of Washington right-wing think tanks, which frankly is what I think they're trying to do. And also get that tax cut. That's the most important thing to them.
How do we get that tax cut? That's a health care cut.
Well, it's, you could look at it, certainly, I think it's a, what I think it is a tax cut masquerading as a healthcare bill. That's what I think it is. I don't think it is. But the last point I want to make is we do need an agreement here on how we go forward. Now, I'm not talking about what we're dealing with right now. I'm talking about the fact that, for example, in Medicare, we're paying in $1 for every $3 that's coming back. And that's not sustainable. We're not going to be able to sustain it if we keep doing that. And it's not all in drug prices, but that's a big part of it. And I think that's a reason why Medicare ought to be able to negotiate drug prices like other parts of the federal government negotiate drug prices. That would make a big difference to people as well. Okay, who's next?
That would be me, sir. Yes. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for letting me come.
So, I have lots of concerns about lots of things, climate change, clean air, clean water. I'm going to choose to use my time around education. President Trump's proposed budget seems to have a lot of proposed cuts around education. We've talked about Medicaid, specifically around projects or programs for Carl Perkins, those kinds of IDEA, really great programs that support our kids. At a time when we are seeing more and more significant and special needs children in our school districts, and as we continue to work harder and harder to create college and career pathways, workforce pathways for our kids, what do you propose to do to support public education, our kids, our teachers, our communities, and what then can we do to support you in those efforts?
Thank you, thank you. So first, I have a friend, as some of you may know, I was on the Gang of Eight that negotiated the immigration bill in the Senate. That was four Democrats and four Republicans. We spent 8 months together negotiating a bill that almost got 70 votes in the Senate, never was brought to a vote in the House. It would have passed the House, and that would have been good for the Roaring Fork Valley and a lot of other places in America. I mention that just because I have a friend who was on that group, who was a Republican. And we would have these conversations from time to time about things we were going to either allow immigrants to have or not have as we made this transition. And so we'd get to something like the earned income tax credit, which is something you only get if you're working by definition. And what he would say in the context of that conversation is, why would we want to be mean? And what I realized over time, over the months, was that in his mind, he's a very conservative Republican, in his mind, what he was distinguishing between, when he said, why does that mean, was his Republican Party versus the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus. And I say that only by way of introduction because I think that budget reflects very much that part of the Republican Party, not the mainstream Republican Party. It may sound presumptuous of me to say that, and I apologize, but when you see the reaction of Republicans on the Senate to that education budget, they're horrified by it. And when they see, you know, Betsy DeVos kind of fiddling around with America's school children based on her ideology, they want none of it. And a lot of them represent rural areas where people say, well, what good will a voucher do my kid if they have to go 60 miles to get to another school? And in specific, what are we going to do for kids, as you mentioned, in special ed, who already are not being funded to the degree that they should be funded in this country to fulfill the promises of IDEA and our commitments to ourselves as Americans. What am I doing? I don't care about any issue more than this. And I'm not talking about his budget. I'm talking about the fact that if you're born poor in America, whether you're rural or urban, by the time you get to kindergarten, you will have heard 30 million fewer words than your more affluent peers. So one thing I'd like to do is figure out how we could provide a lot more early childhood education that's high quality for kids 0 to 5. And I met a mom in Rifle during the campaign who was so happy because they now have a early childhood center there. And she was coming to Glenwood before that for her kid to be, and you know what she said to me? She said to me, I work. And she wasn't complaining, this was just what she said to me. She said, I work so I can have insurance, and every dollar I make goes to pay for my kid to be in this center so I can work. That's the reality that she's living in. And I'm not saying the federal government should provide early childhood education. That's not my position. But as a country, we need to figure out how to give kids an education from 0 to 5 if their parents want them to have it. So that's point one. Point two, we have tolerated a system of public education in this country that for poor children has marooned them in schools that no senator would ever send their kid or their grandkid ever, ever. And there are towns and cities all across the United States where that's true. And so I think we ought to figure out how to deliver kids schools that senators would also send their kids and grandkids. And while we have a long way to go in Denver, I used to be the superintendent, as some of you may know, in Denver Public Schools. We have increased the graduation rate over the last 10 years by 60%. We've increased the college-going rate by 67%. We've increased the Latino graduation rate in our city by 120%. We went from being dead last in student growth of any school district in Colorado of any size to leading the state in growth the last 3 years. So we have a long way to go, but I've seen that it's possible to make real improvements. But we're not going to do it by running schools the way we did 200 years ago. It's a mistake. And then the final point on this subject, or two related points. One is, we have made it virtually impossible for people to go to college without bankrupting their families. And that did not used to be true in Colorado. That did not, we did not accept a world where people graduated and on average had to then spend the next 22 years of their lives paying back their student debt. Except a world where they had to not start a small business because they couldn't take the risk, or with no offense to moms and dads that are here, force them to live at home with their moms and dads because they couldn't afford to live someplace else with their college degree. And there are a whole bunch of reasons why that's so, and I won't bore you with it tonight. We need to fix that, because we have gone from being the world's leading producer of college graduates to being 16th in the world. And if we don't watch it, we're going to be 32nd in the world. And then what we're going to see is a whole bunch of economic malaise that nobody here wants to deal with. Final point on this. We could, and the governor is led on this, and there's a lot of good work being done in Colorado already. Colorado Mountain College is a great example of what I'm talking about here. Because it's not just about affordability, it's also about giving kids, students, skills that they need to be able to earn a living wage in America. That is getting harder and harder to do, and we have not worked hard enough to figure out how to match the training that people get, the credentialing they get, the credits that they get, not necessarily the degree that they get, but the credits they get on the way to a middle-class life that may or may not ultimately lead to a college degree. And there's a lot more we could do on that too. So this budget is dead on arrival when it comes to education in the Senate, and it is within our power to be able to write one that would give not the Senate the ability to educate America's kids, because that's not where it's going to happen. But we could do a lot better job supporting people in early childhood, in K-12, at universities, and folks that are providing apprenticeships and other kinds of opportunities for people in our country to drive the educational levels and attainment that we need. If we had spent 50% of the time in the last presidential election talking about this issue, or 50% of the time we spent talking about trade talking about this issue, I'd be a lot more confident that we were headed in the direction we needed to head. So thank you.
Thanks. So I also have Bryce Hadley, Mindy Pankeel, and Gretchen Brogdon. Come down, please.
I would say if they were here, the Bennett daughters would be very pleased with the ratio of women questioners versus male questioners.
Hi. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for letting me.
Somebody's
phone is up here, by the way. That's your phone. Oh, that's recording me.
So
I'm not even gonna say it.
So I hope the healthcare bill does not pass, but as you know, there are 13 men right now in the Senate working on a rewrite, among them Cory Gardner. I greatly appreciate your voting record on women's health with access to birth control and abortion. And I'm wondering, what are you doing to reach across the aisle to try to influence Cory Gardner to include us in the bill? Hopefully it doesn't pass, but if it's coming up, then, you know, we've got to worry about
well,
it.
Well, I think I'm not going to speak for Senator Gardner in his state, and as I said, he did write in on the Medicaid, so you know, when you call his office, it would be good to say thanks for writing in on the Medicaid. Please make sure that that's reflected in any bill you vote for in the Senate. I can't hold out a lot of hope for you on women's health in this healthcare bill. This was a major part of focus in the House version of the bill. I read yesterday in the paper on the way home from Washington that a place where they were coming to grief in their debate within their caucus was around abortion, because there was a feeling now that the Hyde Amendment wasn't sufficiently restrictive, which was part of the House bill. So I'll continue to make the case, and you know, I mean, I think the most trusted, if you ask, if you poll, not my polls, other many polls that I've read, who the most trusted source of truth is in America right now, you know what comes up with the highest number? Not politicians. Planned Parenthood. And I think the reason for that is that people in rural parts of our country know that that's where you can access health care. In a lot of places, if you're a woman, there are not a lot of other places to get health care. So that's why we have to protect her.
But are you in conversation with Gardner? Are you trying to reach and?
I am, but I keep those conversations to myself, but I am always, yes, but one thing or another.
Senator, I'd like to thank you for proposing the Thompson Divide Withdrawal Protection Act in March of this year. I know that it was referred to committee. I'm curious, A, to know the progress that act has made, B, the pressure that you've put on Senator Gardner to support that act as one of our elected representatives, and C, what we can do to further that as people that care about that area.
Okay, well, on the second point, what I would suggest is that Stacy take him horseback riding.
Do I need to bring him back?
Yes, you do. Yes, you need to bring him back. I think, yes.
He needs to vote on it.
But look, this is, again, I'm not my town hall, not his town hall. He voted, I will say, he voted against the, when the Republicans put on the floor a bill to sell off public lands in the United States, he voted against the Republicans with the Democrats. He's also supported funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is incredibly important to the country and to our state. But I'd love him on Thompson Divide. And I think he should be on Thompson Divide. That's not a Democratic issue. And anybody that meets the ranchers that have worked that land for the last, you know, however many generations knows why people are trying to protect it. And I hope he'll have the chance to do that. And you guys should talk to him. I certainly will. I have. And Congressman Tipton as well, you know. I mean, I on this one, it's hard for me to see why we'd land on out-of-state energy interests instead of in-state ranchers. I don't know why you'd make that choice. So nothing really has happened because it is in committee. The Trump administration is trying to get itself organized. I wasn't trying to be funny. I spent a fair amount of time speaking both with the Secretary of the Interior, for whom I voted, who was Trump's nominee, and also the person that's seeking to be his deputy. I spent quite a amount of time with both of them on Thompson Divide. I can't guarantee success, but it was number one on my list when I was talking. That somebody else mentioned climate. That was also very high on my list. And I'll just say, On that, I don't know if people want to talk about it, but of all the promises the president made when he was running, the one that I actually thought he would break would be pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And I thought he was going to blame it on his daughter and say, you know, she told me I couldn't do such a crazy thing. But it's now done. And that suggests a very clear agenda that we need to pay a lot of attention to, I think.
Thank you.
Senator, I have a more generalized comment and question. I agree with all the issues that we're talking about today. But I also think that a lot of people in this room are like me, and we march, and we call, and we fund, and we're not sitting back. And we have the distractor in chief, the disruptor in chief, and issues that happen, somehow they kind of disappear. Like, whatever happened to seeing our president's tax returns? Why is Jared Kushner allowed to have all kinds of clearance? And nobody seems to be standing up and making, you know, comments about that and asking about that. So I'm curious, who are going to be the leaders of the Democratic Party? Who are we going to look to stay on top of these issues and to provide all of us the kind of leadership that we're looking for?
Okay, great. Great question, because for years I traveled Colorado, and I listened to a lot of comments, but I also got my chance to make them. And one thing I said, and people in this room, some of them heard me say this before, Dorothea, I know, has heard me say this before, which is that Washington had decoupled from America. That the set of priorities that were being pursued, in the Congress in particular, were a different set of priorities than America really cared about. And I would never have imagined in a million years, nor would I have recommended, nor would I have ever endorsed the idea of Donald Trump being the remedy for that problem. But that is a problem. And as the Democratic Party thinks to itself, how, not everybody here is one, but if you are one, I'm one, thinks to itself, how in the world were we careless enough to allow an electoral result like this to happen? We need to reflect on that, and we need to think about that. In my view, the answer doesn't lie in policy decisions that were made 30 years ago, or imagined 30 years ago. The answer lies in a set of policy decisions that have to do with what the future of this country is going to look like, what the role of America is going to be in the world. And the Democratic Party, to be relevant to people, I think is going to have some answers on that. And I'd like to help provide some of that, but I'm only one person. We can all work on that. I do want to mention two things, though, in connection with this. This is also very general, so I'm now going up to 500,000 feet as well. I don't think that we are governing ourselves at a standard that would be acceptable to previous generations of America. And so when you ask a question about why it's okay for a president to not release his tax returns, his answer to that is, I won, so the American people don't care. That's what his answer is. I totally disagree with that. He did win. I'm not saying that he didn't win. But when he puts these policies that could have a profound effect on his family's fortune, he ought to be telling the American people when that's so. And the American people ought to be able to make a judgment about that. When he's got people working for him in the White House that are related to him, that where there are issues about nepotism, he ought to have an answer to that. And we shouldn't just allow it to happen. When he is called a liar by the former head of the FBI in sworn testimony, and the next day he says, I've been completely exonerated. You can't let that stand. And so here are the two points I want to make. And I'm sorry to go on. But are there any teachers here today? Okay. My parent was here. So two points. One, I meet a lot of middle school students and high school students in my job. I have some that live at home. And when I never thought I'd have to have this discussion with middle school students, but now I do, and high school students. And they come to see me in Washington, I say, let's talk a little bit about the importance of edited content. You have to write term papers, right? And they say, in general, they say yes. Sometimes they say no, and then I say, what school are you going to? But in general, you know, I say, you got to write term paper. Yes. In researching a term paper, you use the internet. Yes. And you have to discern, don't you, between what is edited content, what is curated content that will be acceptable to your teacher as you footnote your paper to justify the arguments that you're making, versus some nonsense that's just on the internet. Don't you have to make? Yes, I do. And in my view, as a generation, for better or for worse, we now have the obligation to assert that standard when it comes to politicians in Washington, D.C. And we have to say, we will not send you back there if you're going to make up a bunch of gibberish that you justify by saying you saw it on the internet. And that's a lot of what happens in Washington. There's not an easy answer to it, but I'm deeply worried about it. So we have a job to do here that has to do with this. When President Trump said, and this is a strategy, it's not an accident. Some of what he does is an accident. This is not. When he said that journalists are not covering terrorist acts, do you remember that?
Yes.
And it wasn't just him. The White House listed a list of terrorist attacks that they allege journalists had not covered. And all over the world, not just in America, all over the world, newspapers had to put on the front page hyperlinks to the stories they had written covering the terrorist attacks that the White House said they didn't cover. First of all, what a waste of time. But second, why are you calling these people into question when we know that there are journalists who have given up their lives, who's been beheaded in the Middle East, covering ISIS, covering Syria, trying to tell us what's going on in the rest of the world so we can better understand? And this isn't about political correctness. This is about who we are as a country. And part of who we are as a country is having a free press. And part of being a politician is being able to withstand the scrutiny of the free press without calling them names for doing their job. And people should be skeptical when you hear a politician talking about the fake news. You know, if these people have unearned their credibility somehow because they're not doing the job they should be doing as journalists, I'm all for calling them out. But it's an essential part of our democracy for this to work, for us to have an independent branch of the judiciary, as I mentioned earlier, and for us not to call judges names who render decisions that we don't agree with. So the final point, because I want to leave you with some sense, I hope, of optimism, and then I'll take whatever questions are remaining, and that is this. Look, this is what I also tell the kids when they come in, because they see the Supreme Court, and they see the Senate and the House and the White House and the Lincoln Memorial, and there's a kind of a sense that that it all just was there to begin with, you know? And you remind them of the history, and the people here, their teachers know the history, some others know the history. It's an incredible history of our republic. When the framers met for the Constitution in the summer 230 years ago, and Ben Franklin was out on the steps of the, on a hot summer day, he was out on the steps of Independence Hall, and somebody yelled at him and they said, what form of government are you creating? This is not an apocryphal story, I think this actually happened. What form of government are you creating, a monarchy or a republic? That was the question. And his answer was, a republic if you can keep it. That's what he said. A republic if you can keep it. These guys had no idea, if you read their letters and you read their correspondence with each other and the speeches that they gave, there was no example for what they were trying to set up. There was something called a republic in ancient Rome, that looked nothing like what we were trying to do. There were some small principalities in Switzerland, but there was no one who had tried to establish a republic over a geographic space as big as the 13 colonies. And remember, they weren't states. Virginia was a country to the people from Virginia. Massachusetts, a country. And by the way, as much as many of my colleagues don't like Ted Cruz, let me tell you something. These guys hated each other, some of them. They were founding the country. And I think they would be absolutely astonished if they were here today that we've made it 230 years. Absolutely astonished. They'd be proud, and they would be really pleased that we resolved some business important issues that they were unable to resolve in their generation, like ending slavery, for instance. And I think they would be amazed to know this country is now 330 million people big, and that it stretches from coast to coast with Hawaii and Alaska, that we have the strongest military the planet has ever known, the strongest capacity for national defense that any country has ever known, the strongest economy with all its problems that any group of human beings has ever had. I think they'd be astonished. And we need to remember that in these moments, I think, when everything seems so difficult, and realize that we might not have asked for the fight that we're having now, but it's our obligation to have it now. And it's not just senators and congressmen and reporters, it's all of us. And I hope when we come out at the other end, we'll not only have push back on a bunch of things that are at war with our traditional, most traditional American values, in my view, but we will have reasserted those values for another generation of Americans. And I think that's what I want out of our leadership, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. In fact, that's what I want from Democrats and Republicans.
One last question.
Thank you for coming, and that kind of sounded like a lovely wrap-up of inspiration, and the hour has been lovely to speak to somebody who I agree with, but most of the time I'm calling people who I don't agree with, and as part of Indivisible and people from the Women's March who all really engaged since this election, thank you everybody. We're making phone calls all the time and letters to the editor, and we continue to grapple with, if we explain it within the framework that we're thinking about, the way we're passionate about an issue, it's still not getting across to the person on the other side. And we've heard lots of great things about your opinion, but I would really like to hear some strategies about how we can talk to, when we call Gardner's office, and we call Tipton's office, and we call anybody, what do we need to be saying, and how can we get through? Because we can't just depend on you trying your best. We have to be civically engaged here, and we want to be meaningful. We want to last through 2018.
Well, first of all, let me say that there is your engagement. I want to say thank you for your engagement. I really mean it, and there is nobody that I know that's still breathing that works in the Senate who hasn't noticed there's been a huge change. And it's in the phone calls, it's in the letters, the emails, the Facebook, all the social media, all of it. And by the way, that's also a huge challenge, is figuring out how to use social media for good, which we have to figure out, because I don't think we know the answer for that. Maybe we know a little bit about how to organize around. We don't really know how to govern in the context of social media. I was worried enough about being able to govern in the context of the minutes between commercial breaks on the cable television at night. And now it's gotten even harder than that. So I don't have an answer for that. We have to work on it. I think that where you can thank people for things that they've done that are unexpected, you should thank them for things, like the Land and Water Conservation Fund, like the public lands, and where people suggest that they're with you on an issue, that you have an expectation that they're gonna hang in there. Now, I'm not talking about Corey or Scott Tipton when I answer this. This is what my own, I have my own issues here. question, not my issues, I hope, but I have issues with people that have. The issue is, people will, I was riding behind a truck on the way over here tonight that I hope, I couldn't decide whether I hoped that he was coming into this meeting or not coming to this meeting. There were two bumper stickers he had on. One said Varmint Hunter, and the other one said politicians and diapers should be changed for the same reason. That's what it said. And the thing I worry about with people that are in politics is they're really good at sounding like they're with you, and then they're really good at escaping responsibility when they're not actually with you.
And
I don't have a good answer for that, except that you can't take the mumbo jumbo for as the same as signing up. And I can say this in this room, God knows I can say this in this room. I have had my challenges over the years with the, from time to time, with people that might describe themselves as the base of the Democratic Party in Colorado. And so I agree. I got it. I understand it. And I have some, like, I'll admit maybe all the time I was wrong. I don't think I was wrong all the time. Sometimes you guys are wrong. But what's the point of being in one of these jobs if you're not willing to stand up and say, on this point, I disagree. On 99 other points, I agree, but on this point, I disagree. I find it amazing that there's not a Republican in the Senate who hasn't made it their responsibility in life to be the climate champion for the Republican Party in Washington, D.C. And it's a reflection of a bunch of things, money, gerrymandering, but not the least of which are these things are just bad habits, and we've allowed ourselves to descend to a level of expectation where we say, well, you know, scream and yell at politicians, but we don't have an expectation that we're ever going to see statespeople anymore in any of these jobs. And I don't think that the Republic is redundant. We'll work that way. And so my advice to you is get meetings with these guys. And when they say no, write a letter to the paper saying, we asked for a meeting, we 400 days later, we still don't have one. Let us meet with the staff. If the guy won't meet with us, let us meet with the staff. And let us not come necessarily with a preconceived notion about how this all goes. The longer I'm in this job, the longer I live, the less I think I know. And the more open I am to some suggestions about how we can get from point A to point B. If you care about climate, for example, which I do and which I think a lot of people here do, starting out with the proposition that if you disagree with it, you're an idiot, is not a great way of building a coalition that says we're going to deal with this issue.
Send that bill to President.
And so, look, we're all making this up as we go along. I think this is, you know, a very, very scary time in our political life. I really do. I believe that. But I think it's also a very exciting time. And to see the kinds of turnouts that I've seen in these town halls that I've been doing around the state really, really is gratifying. And I think you and others, need to build on it and turn it into action. I think the thing we have right in front of us right now is where we started, is this healthcare bill in the Senate. And we have 2 weeks to say, do something else. And I think we should make sure our voices are heard during that period of time, that I'm on the floor, that you're doing what you need to do, and that we say, look, it's not the end of the debate whether you pass this or not. It's the beginning of a debate. And it's the beginning of the opportunity for Republicans and Democrats at home to try to work together to fix this.
Single payer now.
Or you can just do that.
I'll tell
him you said so. We are now at our time. It's 6:20. I want to thank all of you for giving me the chance to be here. I really, really appreciate you being here. Great to see you. Don't be shy. Thanks to our mayor. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks you all for coming.
Michael's staff is here and sticking around. If you have other questions or comments, please feel free to reach out. Thank you all for coming this evening, and these doors in the back are open if you want to exit that way. Thanks.